We are going to open the seventh seal. We've been dealing with the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is the apocalypse, the unveiling of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the mighty conquering King, as He returns to claim the world and the universe for His own and to bring history to a close. We've seen that the book falls naturally into three parts. The first part deals with the person of Christ Himself. The second part deals with the seven letters to the seven churches. We looked at those in some detail. And the third part is the so-called prophetic or forward-looking section of the book. And that's the book we've been in for the past several weeks. Now, these prophetic passages deal with the mighty visions that were given to the Apostle John of the end times. He is first, at the beginning of the fourth chapter, is raptured, or raptos being the Greek word, snatched out, lifted up, taken out of history. His experience parallels the experience that every believer will have if that believer happens to be alive at the moment in history when God begins to bring history to a close. That believer will also be raptured, taken out of history, brought into the immediate presence of God, and he will also see the same things that John has seen. So this is a preview for all believers of what we're going to be seeing in heaven while that seven-year period, which Christ referred to as the tribulation and finally the great tribulation, begins on earth. Now, we've seen that that period opens with God holding a scroll in His hand. Who is worthy to take and unroll the scroll? Only Christ, of course. The Lamb who was slain is worthy. Christ begins to open this scroll. The scroll is sealed with seven seals, denoting its great importance. And as He opens each one of these scrolls, a series of judgments is pronounced on the earth. Now, these scrolls, as they are opened, these seals as they are broken, are only preliminary to other judgments which are also coming. There are a total of 21 of them. Seven what are called the seal judgments, then seven trumpet judgments, and then seven bowl judgments or vial judgments as the bowls of wrath of God are poured out on the earth. Now, as each of these seven seals is opened, it's important to remember they're being opened by Christ Himself. God is in control of this process. This is not some roller coaster running out of control down the hill. God is in total control of this part of history as He is of all parts of history. The first four seals, we saw the famous four horsemen of the apocalypse. Of course, the first horse, the white horse, was the white horse of the Antichrist, the deception of the world leader who raises himself up as a false Christ, as a leader who promises the one thing that the world desperately yearns for above all things, and that, of course, is peace. That's a false promise. The second horse, the red horse, is war itself as it breaks out in a series of civil wars and wars between nations. And then following hard on the heels of that horse, of course, is the third horse, which is the black horse of famine, pestilence, and economic collapse. And then, of course, inevitably the pale horse, the fourth seal being broken, introducing the pale horse of Hades and death. The fifth, in this series of breaking seals, the fifth seal is the picture of the martyrs, those who become Christians during the tribulation period and who are killed for their faith because they won't deny Christ, and they are being sheltered under the throne of God Himself. And then the sixth seal was broken to show the fate of those unbelievers, those who do not come to embrace Christ during the tribulation, and what a horror their life becomes. They cannot die in spite of their non-believing. Now, we're thankful for chapter 7 because it's the intermission. God knows we need a break. There's a pause in chapter 7, and in chapter 7 we saw those three fundamental things. First, that the judgment had been stopped, and this is kind of a quick way to remember this. The judgment stopped. You remember the four angels holding back the winds of destruction. Servants sealed, and then the multitude saved. Judgment stopped, servants sealed, multitude saved. We saw in the sealing of the servants 144,000 Jews, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes, being miraculously preserved as they become Christians and in turn spark the greatest evangelical upheaval in all of the history of the world. And many, many tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions, and finally billions of people coming to Christ. Now, we noted in chapter 7, verse 3, that the angels are told not to harm the earth, the sea, or the trees until the servants have been sealed. But now that intermission is over, and the servants have been sealed, And therefore, we can expect that the earth and the trees and lots of other things are going to begin to be harmed. Here then is an overview of chapter 8, which we'll try to get through this morning. The first is the opening of the seventh seal. Ingmar Bergman, the great Swedish director, made a movie called The Seventh Seal one time, you may recall. The opening of the seventh seal. Second, the blowing of the first four trumpets. And third, the soaring of a lone eagle. So there's an opening of the seal, there's the blowing of the first four trumpets, and then there's the soaring of a lone eagle, and then we're going to come to a conclusion. Now, for about the next 30 minutes, we're going to be dealing with this, and the last 3 minutes of this next 30 minutes, we're going to be saying the most important things that we have to say. So if the rest of you would like to sack out for 27 minutes or so, that'll be okay. Any of you who have to leave, and I know that some of you always have to leave early, and that's fine, please do touch base with somebody in the class to get the last 3 minutes worth today, because something that I have missed in reading this until this past week, and I've seen something that has really electrified me, and I want to share it with you, and we'll close with that in the final 3 minutes this morning. All right, here we are with the opening of the seventh seal, chapter 8 of the book of Revelation. Let's read first 1 through 5. When the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Then I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. And another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer, and he was given much incense to mingle with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense rose with the prayers of the saints from the hand of the angel before God. Then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth. And there were peals of thunder, voices, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. Now, we know from our earlier studies that trumpets are always used in Scripture to do one of several things. They're used to get attention. They're used to announce something very important. They're used to herald the coming of the king. They're used to give instructions to announce the opening of a battle. These trumpets will be used to do all of those things, to do all of those things. But the first thing that strikes you about this is that you need to come to grips with two questions in this first five verses. And that is, first, the significance of the silence. And then second, the action of the angel. The significance of the silence and the action of the angel. Let's look at the significance of the silence. Do you remember that the other sealed judgments, as each of the seals was broken, always opened with John seeing and hearing something? The first seal, he opened it and I heard like a voice of thunder, a voice saying, come, and the first rider came out. And the second seal, another voice saying, come, and the third and the fourth the same. Then the fifth seal, he heard the martyrs saying, oh, sovereign Lord, how long will you permit this to go on? And then in the sixth seal, when that was opened, he heard the voices of the non-believers as the thunder and the lightning rolled and roared, saying trees and rocks and mountains fall on us and so on. As each one of the seals is opened, there's been noise, there's been light. This seal is different. It opens with profound silence. Now, why is it that there was silence at the opening of the seventh seal? Why is that? First of all, you notice that it says silence for about half an hour in heaven, about 30 minutes. That was 10 seconds. Does that seem like a long time to you? I know what some of you, Modestate has gone catatonic up there. The people in the front row are going to be injured when he falls over, you see. Unexpected silence produces anxiety, doesn't it? With some of you, it produces relief, I know, but please don't have that. Silence in heaven. Why is that? I don't know whether, and I'm sure you did, you had mothers like I did who, when they really wanted to express, when you were just a little shaved, when they really wanted to express their disbelief at something incredibly stupid that you had done, they were prepared to say something like this. Jack Modest said, Junior, you come in here this minute. Yes, ma'am. And while you're waiting for the dam to break, so you can just imagine all of these things, it's the silence that really gets you. You know, for a kid, I don't know whether you thought about this or not, but you know, there are a lot of kids who are plenty smart that are not much more than, 2 feet tall? I mean, you know, they're about this big, but they're people. They're just little people. And I'm about 6 feet tall. For a kid that was 2 feet tall, I would be three times as big as they are. Now, if somebody walked in here this morning who was three times as big as I am, they would be 18 feet tall. Can you imagine? This ceiling is high enough to accommodate that. 2.5 Ralph Sampsons come walking in here. This is what it looks like to a kid, and all of this 18 feet of massive humanity is silent. It's apoplectic, but it's silent. And can you imagine what a little kid with maybe his sister would be saying in a situation like that? They'd be looking up and they'd be saying, "Man, how do they breathe up there? How much food do you think it takes to keep something like that going? What size shoe do you suppose that thing wears, you know? How are they ever going to get a tailor tot to fit that, you know, something that big?" This huge, and not only are they huge, but they're heavily armed, you know, with switches and paddles and hands this long. And the silence is stupefying. The worst kind of a scream is always a silent scream. And then, you know, finally what comes out after the mother is through with the disciplining is she says something like, "And don't look at me in that tone of voice." You know, something that'll just really reach out and grab you. Silence in heaven is symbolic of the awfulness of what is coming. The silence is awful. And after all of the singing and the praise, it is absolutely thunderous. Some of the commentators have said some things like this. This silence is fearful. It is awesome. It is eerie. It is the calm before the most awful storm ever to break on the earth. Heaven is on tiptoe, holding its breath, and all of the multitudes of heaven, billions of angels, and all of these creatures that we've seen represented are holding their breath, saying, "What will God do next?" The clue to what God is going to do next is the action of the angel. Now, the camera comes in tight on a single angel. The angel is standing at the altar with a censer. Now, you know what a censer is. A censer is one of those things that they swing in some churches into which coals have been put and incense, and so a smoke comes out as a result of that. And this censer was being held, a golden censer was being held by this particular angel in front of the altar. Now, there was in the temple, just as a historical footnote, something called the altar of incense. It was about 3 feet tall, it was made of solid gold, and it was 18 inches square, and it had a little railing around it so that the coals wouldn't fall off. And hot coals were put on it, and then twice a day the priest would come in and sprinkle incense before the prayers and sacrifices the people were given the first time in the morning, and after all of the prayers and the sacrifices had been offered the last time in the evening. And so the idea was that this incense lifted the prayers of the people directly to God. So the incense is seen then as being symbolic of the prayers that are being raised on behalf of the people and from the people to God Himself. Now, the first picture is the angel in the immediate presence of God then offering prayers that have been directed to God. Now, I like that. I like that picture because that answers for me the question, does God hear prayer? Well, you better believe He hears prayer. See, there's nothing between the prayer of the believer and God. Direct access to the immediate presence. But look at what 8.3 says. 8.3b, "He was given much incense to mingle with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar. Mingling the prayers of the saints indicates that in a certain sense, prayers are stored up against the right time. And this is what's been happening here. The prayers of these saints now that have been coming up during the tribulation period are, of course, prayers for relief and prayers for vindication. Man, of course, is in fellowship with God when he's in prayer, isn't he? That's what we say prayer is. Prayer is just communicating with God, just conversation with God. And the smoke and the incense is the picture of the prayers rising. Now, there's an interesting image I want to show you here. And that is that the incense, which is just a little granular powder, has no potency on its own, of course, and it does not rise to God. It must be burned. In other words, it must be transformed in order to be mingled with the prayers and rise to the presence of God. That transformation is accomplished by an agency. You see that? The agent of transformation is the burning coal. The burning coal is the agent of transformation, and that burning coal represents God's righteousness, because it's only through what? God's righteousness and His grace that we're able to commune with God at all, through prayer. So you see how the coal works that way. And now watch what 8.5 says. "Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar," that's the coals, "and threw it on the earth. And there were peals of thunder, voices, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. You see what's happened? The same burning coals that were the agents of transformation and blessing become the agents of destruction. You remember that duality we've seen before? On the one hand, Christ, the Lamb which is offered in sacrifice for the sins of the world. On the other hand, this same Christ, the Lion of Judah. Will you have Him today for your Savior? Will you have Him tomorrow for your Judge? God must think that's really important because He keeps repeating it in different ways all through the study. Okay, then the second picture then is God's answering the prayers of His suffering people with judgment. God answers the prayers of His suffering people and He answers them with judgment. Now, the good news is that the prayers for vindication are heard and they are acted on. The bad news is that the coals are scattered. Now, remember, the coals are the things that cause the prayers to rise. Once the coals are scattered, no more prayers will be acted upon. And what kind of prayers do you suppose they're going to be? Oh, prayers for God to shut it all off. See, once it gets started, do you remember what we looked at in the very first part of the study? This must soon take place. That's a Greek word that says it begins, and when it begins, nothing can stop it, and it closes with a rush. Here is further example of that. The prayers to stop it will not be heard. The coals are scattered. Now, that's the opening of the seventh seal, the significance of the silence and the action of the angel. Now, let's look at the blowing of the trumpets. The blowing of the trumpets, there are seven of them that are going to be blown. We're going to look at the first four here this morning in the eighth chapter. And those first four are direct assaults on the environment of man. The next three will be direct assaults on man himself. The first four then are indirectly assaulting man by assaulting his environment. The next four will assault man directly himself. Now, why is it that God puts judgment onto the environment of man? Well, for that answer, you go back to the book of Genesis, and some of you who are studying in the Bethel series will be fully aware of all of this. God put man on earth with respect to the earth itself in order to do what? He said, I'm putting you in the Garden of Eden, and I want you to cultivate it and to keep it. Now, the theologians call that the dominion covenant. Man is given dominion over all of the earth and all of nature. But with that authority comes what? Great responsibility. And the responsibility is to nurture nature, to treat it tenderly and responsibly, to care for it. And if we do that, then what? The earth sustains us as its master. Now, instead of caring for the earth the way we were commanded by God to do, instead of nurturing it, what has happened? Well, we've declared war on it, haven't we? We've declared war on it. And in our time, we're beginning to see the harvesting of the war that man has declared on nature. We've seen the denuded forests. We've seen the polluted rivers. We've seen the poisoned atmosphere. When Marcia and I were in Africa one time, we actually saw a literal a picture of the declaration of war on nature as the price of ivory went up, and for many, many years, there were 50,000 elephants in East Africa. As long as some 10% or 5,000 elephants were harvested each year, they were kept in perfect balance with the environment, and they did marvelously well. Then the price of ivory went up, and people began to harvest the elephants with machine guns. Now, if you can imagine the army being mobilized to send 50 calibers out on jeeps to mow down whole herds of elephants, literal war against nature. Literal war against nature. Now, God gives us finally, of course, what we demand. He always is faithful to give us finally what we demand. And if finally we say, I don't want to have anything to do with you, and we repeat it long enough, God says, fine, you're free to spend all of eternity absent from me. We have a word for that, and we call it hell. If we say we're declared war on the environment, we intend to subdue it in a way that you didn't intend, but we're going to do it our own way, God finally says, okay, you want your environment destroyed, brother, you got it. And that's what is getting ready to happen as these trumpets are blown. Look at 8, 6, and 7. The seven angels who had the seven trumpets made ready to blow them. And the first trumpet was blown. The first angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire mixed with blood, which fell on the earth. A third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. Can you imagine what that would mean? Does that sound familiar to you? You students of the Old Testament will recognize many of these as being similar to the plagues that descended on Pharaoh and Egypt because of their hardness of heart and their refusal to let the children of Israel go. Similar to that. This descent of judgment on the land is accomplished in two or three particular ways. First, there's hail. You see hail there? First, there's hail. In Job, the Lord is addressed in this way. Hast thou seen the treasure of the hail, which I have reserved against the time of judgment? See, hail is not only a symbol of judgment, it's an instrument of judgment. In Psalms 18, the Lord also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High uttered His voice, hailstones and coals of fire. So hail is the first thing. The second thing that we see here that God uses as an instrument of judgment as He unleashes nature itself against itself is fire. Now, fire, of course, means lightning. I don't know whether you've ever seen the results of a combination terrific lightning storm and terrific hailstorm. When I was a little kid, I was up on my grandparents' farm in East Texas one summer as they were beginning to harvest the cotton. Big black cloud came up. Everybody ran for cover. And the most incredible hailstorm that you can imagine. Big, and they weren't the size of golf balls, but they were the size of your thumb. And they just lashed everything in sight. They were driven almost horizontally by the wind. There was terrific lightning and thunder at the same time. When that was over, and it didn't last more than 30 or 40 minutes, we walked outside, and it was incredible, the devastation. The cotton, which had been almost waist-high, was flat on the ground. Trees had big branches broken off. Pecan trees that were ready to be thrashed had all of the fruit knocked down on the ground. And there was fire in two or three places in the woods where the lightning had struck as well. Just a tiny taste of what's being dealt with here. But when nature is unleashed against herself, the devastation is going to be incredible. Now, you see also that there's a reference to being mixed with blood. There are historical records, as you probably know, of red rain and of red snow stretching back into the early 1800s. In the Mediterranean area, it's sometimes caused by the sands of the Sahara, which are lifted up high into the atmosphere. They become mixed with the rain and the snow, and they actually fall as red rain and snow. In some cases, the snow has been red as much as 6 feet deep in the Pyrenees in modern meteorological history. So the hail comes with the lightning, with the red rain, of course, the red rain being symbolic of blood and of carnage, and destroys. And do you see what's destroyed here? You see what's destroyed? The trees, the grass, and the earth. The trees, the grass, and the earth. A third of the trees are destroyed. The trees which speak of what? The fruit that is given to man to enjoy and to nurture himself. We need the wood in many, many different ways. The pulp which is used for the paper that we deal with. Production of oxygen. Can you imagine what will happen on the earth to the oxygen balance when a third of the trees are destroyed? The grass, when the grass is destroyed, that speaks of what? Not only the grass itself, which our cattle feed on and which are required to sustain them, but wheat, that's the very staff of life, our ability to make bread, corn, all of the grains also being destroyed. The earth and its very capacity to sustain life is being assaulted as this trumpet is blown. And then one last thing about this, and we'll go on. The instrument of destruction are what? Lightning and hail, fire and ice. That's the coldest and the hottest. From the top to the bottom, the left to the right, the in to the out, nothing is going to remain unjudged. Everything is going to be touched. Complete judgment. Well, that picture then shows that nothing that man has done, that's the sins of what? Commission. And nothing that man has not done, that's the sins of omission, are going to be overlooked in the judgment. Everything is going to be judged. Now, that's what's happening just on the land. Now, let's look at what's happening in the sea. 8 and 9. The second angel blew his trumpet. Something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. A third of the sea became blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died. A third of the ships were destroyed. Something like a great mountain burning with fire. What is that? Well, perhaps a huge comet. There's not an explanation of that here. But God uses, again, something from nature to assault nature. And this, of course, is the sea. You see echoes of the Egyptian plagues here again. The blood, symbolic, as before, of destruction and death. The fish diet, says a third of the fish. You know that fish are the greatest source of protein, and protein is necessary to sustain life. Imagine the removal of a third of the total source, world source of protein in one great cataclysm. Ships, a third of the ships are destroyed. That's man's capacity to relate to himself in terms of commerce. take a third of the ships off the sea and see what happens to the commerce. And remember that one of the features of the riding of the horsemen is economic collapse. This is exacerbating that situation. The sea, which is seen as a symbol of the mainstay of all that sustains man, is converted from a blessing into a curse. From a blessing into a curse. All right. That's what happens on the land. That's what happens on the sea. Now there's a judgment even on fresh water. 8, 10, and 11. Third angel blew his trumpet. A great star fell from heaven, blazing like a torch, fell on the third of the rivers and the fountains of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood. Many men died of the water because it was made bitter. Now, that's the ultimate pollution. The pollution of the very fountain of survival on the earth, the fresh water. I don't know whether you've ever gone without water for any extended period of time. I have not. A couple of times when I was in the service, maybe half a day, but I can remember what it was like to really, really be thirsty. Here, the water itself is polluted. It gets so bad that when people drink it, ravening in their thirst, they actually die. In the Old Testament, wormwood is always symbolic of the bitterness that comes as a consequence of idolatry, following other gods. And of course, that's what the judgment of the tribulation is all about. Men have denied Christ persistently. God finally is obliged, because of his righteousness, to judge them. So, we've seen the earth assaulted, the sea assaulted, the sources of fresh water assaulted, and now finally the heavens themselves. 8:12. The fourth angel blew his trumpet. A third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, a third of the stars, so that a third of their light was darkened. A third of the day was kept from shining, and likewise a third of the night. See what's happened here? The light is taken away, literally and figuratively. Light being truth, right? The light is taken away from the unbelieving world. Not only is the light taken away, time itself goes crazy. Time itself goes crazy. A third of the night light is gone. A third of the daylight is gone. How do you measure the very passage of time? I don't know whether Joe Entz is here or not, but he understands navigation. And one of the earliest innovations in navigation was celestial navigation, which became hooked into computers and finally became inertial navigation. If a third of the light of the sun is gone, a third of the light of the night is gone, that's the very things by which man is able to guide and orient himself. You see the picture that God is painting here of progressive deterioration and collapse of the whole fabric of what makes life possible on earth. God, who has given life, is gradually withdrawing the capacity of the earth to sustain life. And all of that, of course, is being done in judgment as a prelude to what Christ is referred to as the outer darkness. The outer darkness where men will what? There will be loud wailing and gnashing of teeth. That final separation from God. So these first four trumpets, you see, are a picture of the elemental forces of nature hurled in judgment against the world. Only partial destruction, you see. There's only a third of this and a third of that, because this is only a prelude to the end. Only a prelude to the end. Now remember that all of the time that this is going on, the four horsemen are riding. The wars are breaking out, the pestilence and the famine, and if that were not enough, all of this is going on too. But as bad as that is, it's only a prelude. It's only a prelude to what's coming. Now, we've seen then the opening of the seventh seal. We've heard the blowing of the trumpets. Let's look briefly then at the soaring of the lone eagle. Then I looked. I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice, and it flew in mid heaven. Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth at the blasts of the other trumpets, which the three angels are about to blow. Now picture this. Do you find it helpful in your own reading of the Bible not only to hear the words, but to try to visualize in your mind what's happening? Sometimes these vivid illustrations that God has given us make it much easier to understand. Picture again what's happened. The four trumpets now have blown. We've seen these pictures of the hail and the fire and the rain. Perhaps massive burning comets crashing into the sea, and now suddenly it's all quiet again. You see that quietness? I looked and I heard an eagle, see? And he's in the mid-heaven, which is the place where the sun stops at midday. So John looks up, and suddenly everything is silent again. And in the brassy dome of the sky, he sees a lone eagle. And the eagle is circling. Some of your Bibles will say angel. The same thing obtains. And this creature that is circling is saying, woe,
woe, woe. If you think this is bad, you ain't seen nothing yet. See? That focus again is on God. The eagle causes John to do what? To look up from the earth where he's been looking down on all of these judgments and back to heaven. Back to heaven from which all of the judgments are coming. All of this, he's reminded, are in God's control. Something I noticed just as I was reading over this again yesterday afternoon. These first judgments that came about, the four horsemen and so on, were all things that God has allowed to happen. And you see that these last ones, these trumpet judgments, are things that God is causing to happen. It moves from God allowing it to God causing it. He cries woe three times. One woe is terrible in the Bible. Two woes is insupportable. Friend, three woes is more woes than anybody can handle. That says something terrible is coming. Do you see, though, how the... Let's step away from this just for a moment as we close. Do you see what the pattern of the tribulation is? The pattern is always like history. There are always a series of warnings. God saying there's going to be judgment, there's going to be trouble, there are going to be problems. Do you hear the warnings? Do you hear the voice? And you know what man's response always is? More rebellion. More rebellion. God turns up the heat and man rebels even more. I drive up and down Interstate 10 a lot on the way to Austin. If you were to get out on Interstate 10 early some morning and begin to see signs that said, bridge out over the Colorado, do not proceed, turn around, detour, go back, and before you ever got to the Colorado River, if you saw 600 of those signs, would you tend to believe that there might possibly be something wrong with the bridge? See, that's what God has done in the Bible. There are over 600 warnings in the Bible about judgment. And over again, he pleads with us. And what do? Oh, the same thing we do on I-10. See, nobody in the Texas Highway Department can tell me what to do, baby. Let's put the hammer down and head for the Colorado. And that's the way it works. And then when we go into the tank, we say, how could a loving Texas Highway Department have allowed the bridge to go out? 600 warnings. I was talking to a guy this week, and we had some time to spend together, and he asked me what I was doing, and I told him mostly I was teaching the book of Revelation. And he said, tell me about that. I don't really know anything about the book of Revelation. So I got a little shot at him. And when I got through kind of giving him an overview, he said, you know, he said, I just don't buy that stuff. I don't buy it. He said, I'll tell you the reason I don't buy it. He said, I don't buy it because the God I worship wouldn't be that cruel. He wouldn't be that cruel. The God I worship is a God of love and a God of peace and a God of beauty and a God of joy. And I said, listen, you know, the God I worship goes along with all that too, but then there's another aspect. You know, one of the things I think that our problem is here in Houston, we're insulated. We're insulated. See, if we lived in Vietnam, if we lived in Vietnam and somebody were to tell us about the devastation of war, we'd be able to relate to that. If we lived in Ethiopia and somebody were to tell us about the devastation and the horror of starvation, we'd be able to relate to that. If we lived on the streets of Calcutta, where Mother Teresa has her missions, and somebody were to tell us about the terror of the pestilence that sweeps and kills tens of thousands, we'd be able to relate to that. But we're insulated here. So a lot of this stuff just sounds like something somebody has dreamed up. But God, in fact, is upping the ante. Do you see that each of these things becomes progressively more difficult to deal with, progressively more horrible to contemplate, progressively more heat and more pressure? Okay, now I'm going to tell you the thing that I missed. I want to ask you all something. As we have gone through these studies together, have you come to the place that you've wondered, I wonder how much of that is real, and I wonder how much of it is just stuff. I mean, you know, I think the Bible is okay, and I think that there's a lot of good things in there, but there's a lot of this Revelations business that just doesn't ring true. And I mean, how do we know this, and how do we know that? I want to share something with you that I saw for the first time yesterday afternoon about 2 o'clock, and I really got excited about it. As I began to reread the first part of the book of Revelation, I saw that there was something different about it. Let me tell you what I saw that was different. Revelation 1:8 says, I am the Alpha and the Omega. Revelation 2:2 says, I know your works. 2:25, hold fast. 3:22 says, let him hear. And now let me show you something. With the fourth chapter, you begin to hear words like this. I looked and I saw, I heard, they sang and cried. English majors, what's happened? Shifted tenses. Do you hear that? The first part of the book of Revelation is all told in the present tense. The rest of the book of Revelation, beginning with chapter 4, as you begin to shift into the future, God shifts into the past tense. He speaks of the future as though it had already happened. I've got this Bible in my left hand. I put it in my right hand. Now, that happened about 8 seconds ago. How certain are you, let's assume I'm not a sleight of hand artist, how certain are you that I moved the Bible from my left hand to my right hand? Most of you would say, that's certain stuff. If I were to come to Ben Ditto and say, Ben, I'll bet you $50 that the Japanese are going to attack Pearl Harbor in 1941 and that they will ultimately be defeated in the Second World War after the atomic bomb is dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, he would say, come on, give me a break. See, that's already happened. That's already written in the history book. Right. And this is God's history book. And what I believe, ladies and gentlemen, is afoot here is that God is giving us another one of those little subtle reminders that what for Him is in the future, what for us is in the future, for Him is in the past. It's as good as already done. If somebody asks you how certain it is that this book of Revelation is predictive of what is going to happen and how it's going to happen, you say, within the limits of our human ability to take and interpret some of these difficult passages, friend, it's as good as though it had already happened. Now, not only is this book of Revelation going to happen just like it says it's going to happen, let me tell you what it's not like. It's not like the TV program The Day After. It's not like one of Isaac Asimov's science fiction dramas. It is not like one of George Lucas' Star Wars movies. It is not a dream that becomes a nightmare, but it is a nightmare that becomes reality from which there is no awakening and no escape. Let me give you one phrase that helps me to remember what I think I just said, and that is this. Christians, you have the past to look forward to. Christians, you have the past to look forward to. It is so certain that it's going to happen that it is as though it had already happened. God sees history as being complete, my friends. This book is not only predictive in the sense that it looks forward, it's a report. In God's eyes, it's already done. That's how certain we can be. Next week, we're going to come up against a passage that makes this one look like Ned and the Third Reader. Because next week, the demons that have been chained in hell for millions of years are released. And the consequences of that on the unbelievers during the tribulation period are awful. Now, please don't everybody not show up on the same Sunday, because I don't want to be up here all by myself going through this next week. Next week, we'll deal with the final portions of the trumpet judgments as we get into chapter 9. These are tough passages, folks, but let's remember that in the midst of judgment, God remembers mercy. Let's remember why God is doing this. He's extending the time in order that more might come. Even during the tribulation period, while everything is coming unraveled, while all of the earth as we know it is literally coming to pieces, God still says, come home. There's one last thing that I want to leave you with, and that is this. This is one of those between the lines interpretations. I believe that with all of the jubilation and all of the shouting, all of the thunderings and all of the lightning, with all of the silence of heaven, there is one last thing that God would have us see here. And that is that because of the great heart of the loving Father, as these terrible miseries are unleashed on the world, there is a great tear rolling down the cheek of God. Father, this morning we thank you for your word. We thank you that you're there, Lord. We thank you that you're true. Help us to be faithful. Help us to hang in as we deal with these difficult passages. And we thank you that you will, in Jesus' name. Amen.